Sam tried to swallow and found that his throat had clenched like a fist. What do we do? What the hell are we supposed to do? The answer came to him without warning. We have to go back to the house, Sam told them there on the sidewalk in Brooklyn, as dusk swept over the borough like a hungry purple shadow. The group exchanged confused glances. To Kill Creek? Moore asked. Sam nodded. For what? Sebastian asked incredulously. Sebastian, whatever this is, it's reaching into our lives over thousands of miles. We'll never be free of it unless we find a way to stop it.
How? What do you think we can possibly accomplish by returning to that house?
We don't know. Sam turned to find Moore, her hands buried deep in the pockets of a fitted black trench coat, the wind blowing her long black hair back and forth like a pendulum. But Sam's right. We have to go. And you're coming with us. The old man scoffed.
And why on earth would I?
And the first brick broke free, Sam said. A breath caught in Sebastian's throat.
How do you know about that?
It's where you stopped writing, isn't it? Sebastian did not reply. It's the last line all of us wrote, Sam continued. All of our stories were stopped by that brick wall. A wall exactly like the one at Kill Creek. We have to get into that room, Sebastian.
For what? What's inside?
Sam shook his head. I don't know, he admitted, wishing he had some answer, any answer. You heard what Adudel said, Moore told Sebastian. The house needs a storyteller. That's what it's been doing since last November. It's been forcing us to tell its story. A thought flashed through Sam's mind. It's been testing us to choose one of us. He stared at Sebastian. So alive, body and mind rejuvenated. And he couldn't help wondering if the house had made its choice. Moore reached out and took the old man's hand in hers. We can't ignore this any longer, Sebastian. This isn't in our heads. Something is after us. The great Sebastian Cole, legendary author of hundreds of books and short stories, influencer of countless other writers, looked down at the hand of T.C. Moore and gripped it tight. He ran his thumb over the tops of her smooth fingers.
Your nails are a mess, he said.
Moore smiled warmly. A lot of things have gotten neglected lately. You should see my bush. An unexpected laugh caught them by surprise, but they welcomed the brief reprieve. For that fleeting moment, they felt free. Only Daniel wasn't laughing. His hands were balled into tight fists.
Okay, I'll go, Sebastian said, giving Sam an odd hint of a smile.
A knowing smile. And then he let Moore lead him away. They reached Washington Avenue. Horns honked, engines revved, headlights flashed by on the busy street. They waited at the corner until the light turned green, then crossed in a jagged line, Wainwright leading the way. Daniel brushed past Sam, forcing Moore and Sebastian to the edge of the crosswalk as he passed. He was clenching and unclenching his fists over and over. His face was redder than usual, a bulging vein running like a tributary of hate down the length of his neck. Daniel, Sam called after him. He did not respond. Wainwright was digging into his pocket, searching for his car keys. He had no idea that Daniel was storming up behind him. Sam opened his mouth to warn him, but he was too late. Daniel pounded Wainwright square in the back. The force sent Wainwright stumbling, arms waving widely as he tried in vain to regain his balance. He hit the sidewalk hard, his knees driven painfully into the buckled concrete. Twisting his head at an awkward angle, he peered up at the heaving form standing over him.
This is all your fault!
Tears were streaming down Daniel's cheeks.
You made us go there! You made us wake it up! Wainwright stammered, a jumble of sounds trying desperately to form an explanation.
She's dead!
Daniel screamed.
She's dead because of you!
His tongue found its footing and Wainwright pushed out the words.
I know she's dead. Kate was...
Not Kate!
Daniel leaned down to give Wainwright the full force of his voice.
Not Kate! Claire! Claire, you son of a bitch!
The name meant nothing to Wainwright. He stared up at Daniel, his face scrunched up in confusion. But Sam understood. He glanced over at Moore. Her expression confirmed what Sam feared. He's lost it. Daniel reared back his fist, readying another punch. Suddenly, Sam leapt forward, hooking his heavily tattooed arm around Daniel's and yanking him back. Even though Daniel was still a good 70 pounds heavier, Sam was able to drag the blubbering man off of the sidewalk and out into the street, slamming him roughly against the back of Wainwright's car.
He didn't kill your daughter, Sam said in Daniel's ear. That was an accident.
It was all boiling over now. The deluge of tears that Daniel had held back for months coursed down his face. Someone was pushing Sam aside. It was Moore. She slipped in front of Sam and took Daniel's large face in her hand. Her eyes glistened as she held his gaze. Daniel's entire body began to quiver. Tears raced down his cheeks, but he did not look away from Moore.
She's trapped, he whispered. It has her. It won't let her rest.
Moore loosened her hold, resting her hand on his cheek. The rivulets of tears changed course around her fingertips. Sam stepped back. He held out a hand to Wainwright. Let me help you up. But the young man simply stared up at him, his eyes glistening with his own fresh tears, his lips trembling.
Is that Edudel?
Sebastian squinted as he looked across the street. On the other side, a man stood at the curb, leaning his weight on a wooden cane. Wainwright and Daniel both got to their feet, their altercation momentarily forgotten.
What's that crazy bastard want?
Moore asked.
Edudel was yelling something, his head tilted back as he attempted to project his voice over the sound of the traffic.
Sam frowned. What's he saying?
I don't know, Sebastian replied.
He cupped his hands around his mouth and called out,
We can't hear you!
A cluster of cars whizzed by, and then both lanes cleared in a sudden break in traffic. The wind, still carrying the last chill of winter, swirled around them, and then it too died down. Adrudel's words found their way to the group.
You belong to the house now!
Sebastian waved a hand, motioning toward the other side of the street.
We'll come back over, he yelled. Stay there! We'll come to you!
Edudel let go of the silver lion's head and his cane fell to the sidewalk like a toppled tree. He seemed to take a deep breath, as if preparing for a deep dive.
You will always belong to the house, he said.
Edudel stepped off the curb.
Oh, Christ!
Wainwright gasped. The bus hit Edudel full force. 1 second he was there, staring at them through those ridiculously large eyeglasses, and the next he was gone, slammed to the street and dragged under the bus's front bumper. The brakes screamed as the bus tried, too late, to come to a stop. The crumpled form of Edudel tumbled out from behind the bus, arms and legs flailing as his body bounced along the street before coming to rest. He lay on his stomach, his cheek flat against the asphalt. His glasses were still on, but one lens was shattered, the other missing entirely. His eyes were bleached stones with a speck of black at the center. Half of his head was caved in. White shards of skull poked through hair matted with dark, thick blood. His right arm was twisted over the top of his body at an unnatural angle. A stalk of pale bone sprouted from his forearm. His hand was curled into a limp fist, but one finger was extended. Sam felt that finger pointing directly at them like the barrel of a gun.
Nearby, someone screamed. Voices cried out. The street was filled with slowing cars and frantic pedestrians. Sam did not move, nor did Wainwright or Moore or Sebastian or Daniel. They watched in stunned silence as the mangled body of Dr. Malcolm Adriel was engulfed by the crowd. From a rooftop above them, a flock of pigeons scattered, black bodies disappearing into a sky bruised by dusk. They could flee. They could fly far, far away. But they could never escape. Part 4. The Phantom Limb. April 25th. What would I give to prove to you that the force within that house is real? What deal would I gladly strike if only I could convince you, dear reader, that what I experienced within those walls was not a figment of my imagination? Nothing. I would give nothing. Because I know in my heart that it is true. And if you still refuse to believe in the power of the house on Kill Creek, well, I can only urge you to visit it yourself. Once you have, once you've stepped through that doorway and walked its shadowed halls, you will believe. You will believe. Dr. Malcolm Adriel, Phantoms of the Prairie. 26. 9:15 a.m. Sam stared out the window and watched, as, thousands of feet below, a commercial airliner seemed to hang motionless in air. The world was a patchwork of roads and fields stretching out to the curved horizon. He closed his eyes. I'm safe up here, he thought. It felt true. Rocketing through the air at over 500 miles per hour, 45,000 feet above the earth, he could not feel the pull of the house. It was a speck among specks somewhere far below. But eventually we have to land. We can't stay up here forever. He tried to push that moment as far away from him as possible. No one had noticed when they left the scene of the accident in Brooklyn. Traffic was already backed up for several blocks in either direction. Horns bleated in a harsh, uneven rhythm. The street was filled with people, some comforting the ashen-faced bus driver, others forming a circle around Adriel's mangled body. Faces peered out of the back windows of the bus, a wall of wide eyes and open mouths. In the distance, sirens wailed. It was Moore who said they should leave. At first, Sebastian refused.
We have to stay, he insisted. There must be something we can do. Something.
The sirens were getting closer. Wainwright and Daniel were already climbing into the car. Sam put a hand on Sebastian's arm and said, We have to go. Wainwright took the first right. Sam glanced back and saw the flashing lights of a police car arriving, and then Wainwright took a quick left, and the horrible scene was gone from sight. For 10 minutes they rode in silence. There did not appear to be any rhyme or reason to where Wainwright was taking them, just a desire to put what had happened far behind them. Even Wainwright seemed surprised when somehow they made their way back to his apartment. They would spend the night there. They would try to get some sleep. They would talk in the morning. They needed a plan. To charter a private jet from LaGuardia to Kansas City International was over $20,000. But none of them could stomach the thought of being crammed onto a commercial flight with the weight of their situation pressing down on them. Wainwright had a service he used, mostly for international travel. Luckily, the company was able to accommodate their last-minute request. It was Sam's first time on a private jet. He had always imagined he would be intimidated by the extravagance of the experience. But now he sat in a lush leather chair, staring out the small window at the world far below, and the entire situation sickened him. He glanced over at Sebastian in the opposite seat. The old man was staring straight ahead, but it wasn't the vacant look Sam had seen in his eyes last October. Sebastian's brow was creased, his eyes fixed on the open space before him. He was not adrift in a mental fog. He was lost in deep thoughts.
Sebastian? Sam called over.
Yes, Sam?
Sebastian tried to muster up a friendly smile. Sam looked around the cabin. Daniel and Wainwright were in the next row. Wainwright was cradling his head in his hands, his eyes closed, while Daniel had fallen into a shallow sleep. The exhaustion of the ordeal finally too much to fight. His body flinched slightly as unwanted dreams attempted to overtake him. Toward the rear of the plane there were four seats, two side by side and facing the tail, and another pair opposite those facing forward. Sam could see the back of Moira's head, the ridge of her black hair rising up over the seat like a shark's fin. Careful to keep his voice low, Sam leaned over close to Sebastian.
What do you think we're going to find? He asked.
The question seemed to catch Sebastian off guard.
At the house?
Sam nodded. Sebastian pondered this for a moment.
I truly do not know.
But you talked to Adedale several times. He must have mentioned something.
I know as much as you,
Sebastian insisted.
I want to believe him, but I don't.
Careful not to draw the attention of the others, Sam quietly rose from his seat and crossed over to crouch down in front of Sebastian. The old man could not look away now.
What aren't you telling me? Sam asked.
Sebastian opened his mouth to say something, then thought better of it. He reconsidered and began again.
And the first brick broke free. The books you've all been writing, you said they stopped cold with that sentence.
That's right.
That exact sentence is in my book as well,
Sebastian admitted.
I remember writing it.
Because it's where you stopped too?
Sebastian shook his head.
It was like the phrase exploded out of my mind, and the sheer force of it propelled me forward.
Sam cocked his head, confused.
Forward?
I've always been a bit of a pokey writer, Sebastian continued. Not the slam-bam thank-you-ma'am type like Moore, but this was different than anything I had ever written. Since November, the story had chugged nicely along.
Not how I would describe my writing experience the past few months.
Sebastian held his hands out flat to mime pushing some unseen object.
But when I wrote that sentence, it was like something gave me a hard shove, and then I was racing to the finish line.
The finish line? Sam repeated. Wait, are you saying...
The old man did not need Sam to complete the thought.
My novel is complete, he said. I finished it a week ago.
The same time my story came to a sudden stop, when all of us stopped writing. Because it wasn't necessary anymore,
Sam realized.
He beat us, because the house had chosen him.
Sebastian's words echoed in Sam's mind.
The finish line.
How does it end? Sam asked, his voice barely audible over the steady roar of the jet engine.
It doesn't matter how...
Sebastian, how does it end? How does your story end?
The plane arced softly just then, and the morning sunlight fell upon Sebastian's face.
The evil wins,
he said, peering out the window at the field of clouds below.
They can't stop it, and the evil wins.
The leather chair gave a soft squeak as Sam sat down. Moore did not bother looking over as she said dryly, "Please, have a seat." Sam glanced back to where the others sat. They had not noticed him moving to the rear of the plane.
Good. I don't need Daniel and Wainwright hearing this, Sam told himself. Not yet.
His face must have betrayed his thoughts, because Moore turned to him, suddenly concerned.
What is it? She asked. Sebastian finished his book,
Sam whispered, his mind still reeling. Moore straightened up in her chair. What? It's done. He finished it on the same day that the rest of us got... whatever we got. Writer's block. Did he tell you anything else? What happens in the story? What's behind the wall? He doesn't know, Sam said. Moore stared at him, mouth agape. He doesn't know. He wrote the damn thing. He says that the wall falls free and whatever is there is so strange, so foreign, that the main character can't make sense of it. Moore snorted, annoyed, and looked back out the window. Classic Sebastian Cole, cosmic horror bullshit. Well, that's convenient. Did he say anything else? Only that the evil... Sam paused, afraid to say it himself, to make it true. Let's just say the good guys don't exactly come out on top. Moore sucked in a sharp breath. She's scared, he realized. T.C. Moore, scared. 6 months ago, he wouldn't have thought that was possible. The jet turned slightly, and the sunlight that had been shining on Moore's face shifted, a deep shadow cutting across her cheek. I keep thinking about that night, at the house, she said, her voice surprisingly faint. I have this feeling like something happened there, but I can't quite remember what it was. Suddenly Sam could feel Moore's body pressing against him, his fingers on her skin, his lips on her lips. A dream, he realized. I had a dream that night. About her. About us. It all came rushing back to him, sensations cascading out of the darkness. The taste of her mouth, the smell of her skin, his fingers sliding along her sweaty flesh as he fell deeper and deeper into the absolute blackness of her eye. And you told her. You told her everything. In that dream. In the house. His heart began to thud in his chest, like a wild beast in a cage. How did it come to you? She asked. Sam drew in a sharp breath. How did what? When you would stop writing. What did it look like? I mean, when you actually saw it. Tell her. She won't understand. His mind warned. Yes, she will. You want to tell her. You need to tell her. Leaning forward, Sam clasped his hands. He took a deep breath, but he did not speak. Not yet. She'll understand, he assured himself. Because she's known pain, like you. He stared down at his clasped hands. He used to hold his hands like that when he prayed, when he was a little boy, back when he believed. Tell her. It looked like my mother. Moore turned away from the window. She was watching him, her expression intense. Your mother. She died in a house fire, right? He did not immediately answer. Slowly he began to nod. Yeah. There was a fire, but... He swallowed hard. She didn't die in it. What do you mean? There was 10-year-old Sammy McGarver, standing before the inferno that had once been their simple country home. His mother's body was inside, but the fire hadn't killed her. She was already dead. And there was Jack by his side. We can't tell anyone, Jack was saying. Not even Dad. That's when Sam had broken away from his brother and run toward the flames. Sam rubbed his hand over the burned skin of his left arm. My mom hated us, my brother and me. She blamed us for all of the unhappiness in her life. She wished she had never had us. She felt trapped in a family she never wanted. So she drank and she yelled and she called us names. She called us worthless. She called us ungrateful little shits. And when that didn't make her feel good enough, she would hit us. Moore leaned forward, her face level with Sam's. What about your father? He was weak. Honestly, I think he was afraid of her. He would try to calm her down, to talk reason, but... Sam gripped his arm harder, rubbing his thumb over the folded flesh. I knew that my dad wasn't going to save us. Even as a little kid, I think I knew eventually it would have to be me or Jack who stood up to her. Sam's eyes flashed to the front of the cabin. The others had not moved. Between the distance and the sound of the engines, there was no way they could hear him. Yet he felt as if everyone was listening. Sebastian, Daniel, Wainwright. Even the house, so far below, was hanging on his every word.
Stop. Don't let them in,
his mind warned. Moore must have sensed that he was retreating. She reached up and pulled her black mane over her shoulder, clutching the end in one hand like a ripcord, as if she could pull it should things get too real. For me, it was my ex-boyfriend, she said, her voice intimate, almost a whisper. His name was Bobby. I was young, barely out of high school, living in a shithole house in a shithole desert town northeast of Los Angeles. Back then, I wasn't T.C. Moore. I was just a good Catholic girl named Teresa Catherine, and Bobby was everything. Until he did this. She pointed to her ruptured pupil. Sam felt his mouth open to speak, but he had no idea what to say. I'm sorry, he offered finally. I'm not, Moore said. I was used to Bobby kicking my ass. It had just become a part of my life. But when I saw my eye in the mirror for the first time, when I saw how that darkness had opened up, it was like staring into another universe. One where I didn't have to be good, obedient Teresa anymore. So one day I just left him. I moved to L.A. and T.C. Moore was born. And I never saw Bobby again. Until now, Sam said. Moore nodded. I started hearing his voice, calling from somewhere in my house. Teresa, Teresa. She said the name in a lilting, sing-song way, and the sound of it made Sam's skin crawl. When I wrote, the voice would stop. But a few times I tried to quit on the novel, to stop because I knew that it was taking over my life, and that's when he would find me. The edges of her eyes glistened with tears. It felt real, Sam. Exactly like the way it did back then. The pain, the fear. It even knew what I had to say to make him stop. I had to tell him how worthless I was. I had to make him feel like a big man. A single tear escaped her eye and raced down her cheek. She angrily wiped it away. It wasn't just the feeling of being back at Kill Creek that made me keep writing. I did it to keep him away. He reached out and took her hand. It felt strangely familiar. Her fingers folded into his. Because it happened before. At the Finch house. In the dream. But it can't really be Bobby, Moore was saying. He's alive. Last I heard, he was living in Arizona. He's an abusive asshole, but he's not a goddamn ghost. It's not him, Sam told her. Just like it's not my mother. It's the house using those things to get to us, to break us down. How could it know? Because she told it. Just like I told it about my mother, when I told Moore that night, when she came to my room. But she wasn't really there. That wasn't Moore. That was the house. Sam felt as if the floor of the plane had vanished. He was plunging through the open air, spiraling toward the earth. It was listening, he said. What are you talking about? The house. When we were there last fall, it was listening to our conversations, to our thoughts. We told it everything it needed to know to break us down. That's impossible, Moore said, but there was doubt in her voice. Because she knows you could be right, Sam thought. It used my ex because he beat me and your mother because she, what, resented your very existence? Sam remembered the dream in the house and the relief he felt when he whispered those words in her ear.
You can feel that again, he realized. No, stop talking. It was a mistake the first time.
Because it was the house. This is more, the real more.
Tell her.
Sam? She asked, confused. That's not the only reason, Sam said. He swallowed hard, searching for courage.
Keep going.
Sam, you don't have to.
Yes, you do. Tell her.
I killed my mother, he said. They were the hardest four words he had ever spoken aloud. Shock rippled across Moore's face, like the gently disturbed surface of a pond, her eyes widening, her brows arching, her lips parting to suck in a breath. And then her entire expression flattened, the gravity of Sam's confession pulling her closer. Sam did not seem to see her there. He was lost in a memory.
She was hurting my brother. She was slapping him. She had him on the floor and her hands were around his neck. She was squeezing. He couldn't breathe. His face was red and then purple, and I was watching him die. I was watching my brother die. So I picked up a cast iron skillet, and I hit her with it, to stop her, and...
Moore touched his arm, her hand resting on his scars. He looked up into her eyes.
She burned in that fire, but she didn't die in it.
Sam watched as tears began to slip down Moore's cheeks, and then his own tears came, spilling over, dripping off the edge of his jaw and splashing onto the deformed flesh of his left arm.
And it knows. Whatever this thing is, it knows.
Sam thought of his mother's corpse, motionless on the kitchen floor. He thought of the salvation he found in a novel by Sebastian Cole, third paperback from the top in a stack on a pawn shop shelf. He thought of the life these two things created, a life of stories and secrets, a life that had driven Aaron away and left Sam desperate enough to accept Wainwright's invitation to the house on Kill Creek. And suddenly this moment in which he found himself felt inevitable, fated. The plane dipped sharply. They were starting their descent. Soon they would be on the ground. 27. 11:32 a.m. The hardware store was on Quivira Road in Lenexa, Kansas, a rare mom-and-pop joint that refused to be killed off by the many chains that populated Kansas City and its suburbs. Sam led the way.
He's on a mission,
Moore observed as she walked faster to keep up. Sam was, after all, the one who came up with the plan. As the plane descended into Kansas City International Airport, he had gathered them all together. Each of their novels had led them to a wall, a brick wall, exactly like the one that kept anyone from entering the third-floor bedroom in the Finch house. There had to be a reason for that, Sam insisted. The key to truly understanding the house and its power could be behind that wall. And if they understood it, they might be able to stop it. Wainwright was skeptical, and he wasn't afraid to voice it.
The house was forcing you to write those stories. It might want you, us, to go back. It could be a trap.
So what do we do? Sam's question wasn't just to Wainwright, but to the entire group. Go home? Let this thing drive us crazy? Or worse? We know what it did to Kate. We saw what it did to Adadel. There's no one to turn to. Who's going to help us? The police? The church? The one man who knew the most about that house stepped in front of a goddamn bus. He had paused, waiting for any of them to protest. They had said nothing. If anyone else has a better idea, trust me, I would love to hear it. The screech of the jet's tires hitting the runway had been the only reply. So, like Wainwright, Daniel, and Sebastian, Moore followed Sam as he pushed a shopping cart through the narrow aisles of the hardware store. Their private conversation on the plane appeared to have freed Sam of a weight he had carried his entire life. Moore could see that for the moment he was enjoying a slight reprieve from the crushing burden of keeping the secret. There was momentum, and for that Moore was thankful. 6 months of stasis, of keeping herself secluded while she pounded out a never-ending book, had left her feeling something she had not truly felt in 2 decades. Helplessness. Now they were charging forward. Toward what? She didn't know. None of them did. They had no idea what to expect once they arrived at the house. But Sam's right. We can't just go home. We know what's waiting for us there. Along the back wall of the store were hammers of various weights and sizes. Sam grabbed the heaviest of the sledgehammers, a 20-pounder. He tested its weight in his hands and, apparently satisfied, set it carefully in the cart. He then added a 64-ounce blacksmith hammer, a 48-ounce dead blow hammer, and a standard milled face framing hammer with a smooth hickory handle. Finally, he found a 12-inch concrete chisel and tossed that into the cart. "That should do it," Sam said. "You're sure you don't want to just rent a jackhammer and call it a day?" Moore asked. Sebastian peered into the cart.
"She does have a point. It's an old wall of 8-inch clay bricks, Sam. I assumed the sledge would do."
Sam's response to the old man was flat and emotionless. "I'm not taking any chances. I want to get that wall down as quickly as possible." Sebastian gave a small nod and looked away, oddly cowed. Sam doesn't trust him, Moore realized. They moved down the next aisle, toward the front of the store. Moore sidled up next to Sam, her hand on the side of the cart. "What are we hoping to find behind the wall, Sam?" she asked him. "Rebecca's bedroom," he said a bit too quickly. "Maybe something that can help us understand what's happening." Moore eyed the other customers as they passed. People going about their lives, oblivious to the torment she and the others were suffering. "I've been thinking about what might be in that room," she said, her voice low. "The ghost of Rebecca Finch, or Joshua Goodman, or the things it sent to each of us." The thought made her shiver. Sam let out a slow breath. "Or maybe it's something else, something that never lived," he suggested. "Or it's just a room," Moore thought, "and we're all out of our goddamn minds." They reached the end of the aisle. A single register was straight ahead, the line of customers long and moving slowly. Moore leaned in closer to Sam, her words only for him. "If we break down that wall and the spirit of a Finch sister possesses one of you guys, I will not hesitate to take that sledge and turn your head into brain pudding." She grinned devilishly. "Is it wrong that I hope it's Wainwright?" A smile broke through Sam's serious expression. "That's good," Moore thought. "It's almost like everything's normal again." As quickly as it appeared, his smile faded. She watched as Sam pushed the cart up to the end of the line, Sebastian falling in silently behind him. Daniel, his hands in his pockets, shuffled after them. There was no warmth among these men, no camaraderie, only sadness and suspicion. Wainwright stepped up next to Moore.
"Do you think this is going to work?"
he asked, his once booming voice now thin and weak. "It'll work," Moore said sharply. "It has to work," she told herself. "We'll beat that wall to hell until it comes down. And whatever the house throws our way, you'll what?" her mind questioned. "We'll deal. We'll improvise." Even as she thought it, she hated the sound of the word. Improvise. It suggested a sudden change of plans, a desperate attempt to regain control. It meant that things could go sideways, and they'd be taking swings in the dark. The wheels of the cart rumbled wildly as Sam guided it toward the rental SUV parked at the curb. Wainwright pressed a button on the key fob, and the tailgate rose gently into the air, revealing their hastily packed bags and just enough cargo space for the tools. Sebastian unzipped a dark canvas bag he had found near the front of the store and opened it for Sam and Wainwright to fill with the smaller hammers. It was then that Moore spotted something a few doors down.
"Don't bother," her mind told her. "It will only take a second. It can't hurt." "It's a waste of time," her mind insisted.
She ignored the thought and turned to the others. "Be right back," she told them.
"Now where is she off to?"
she heard Sebastian ask as she hurried down the sidewalk. A bell above the door gave a friendly ding as Moore entered the used bookstore. She was instantly greeted by the glorious scent of pages. Hundreds of thousands of pages, aging silently between their respective covers. A plump woman smiled warmly.
"Good morning. Can I help you find anything?"
"Where's your religion section?" Moore asked impatiently as she glanced over the cluttered shelves.
"Oh, well now, are you wanting Eastern or Western religion? Because if you're interested in Buddhism, I have a beautifully illustrated copy of the..."
"Lady, just hold out a finger and point," Moore snapped. The woman's smile vanished. She did as she was told, pointing to a section at the top of a nearby bookshelf. Moore quickly scanned the titles and found what she was looking for. As she pulled the book down from the shelf, a young girl's voice spoke from the recesses of her mind, words echoing from decades ago, back when she believed in such magic.
"She girds her loins with strength and shows that her arms are strong." "That's right, Teresa," Moore thought. "Stronger than you were. Too strong to ever go back."
Moore dropped the book onto the counter and fished out a 20, more than enough to cover the handwritten price displayed on a small yellow sticker. She held out the bill. "Here." The woman did not move. A low growl came from the far corner behind the counter.
"Jasmine doesn't like you," the woman said.
Moore sighed, irritated. "Who the hell is Jasmine?" From around a stack of paperback romance novels, a long-haired cat the color of dirty dishwater peered out with yellow eyes. It stared straight at Moore as it growled from deep within its chest.
"Jasmine thinks you're very, very rude."
The cat lowered its head, but kept its eyes on Moore as it issued another warning, louder than the first two. Moore dropped the 20 onto the counter and snatched up the book.
"Yeah, well, Jasmine looks like a real bitch."
The ring of the bell seemed much less friendly as Moore hurried out of the store. The others were already in the SUV. Wainwright was behind the wheel. He rolled down the driver's side window as Moore approached.
"What was so important?" he asked.
Moore held up her find, a leather-bound copy of the Holy Bible.
"I didn't think you were a believer,"
Sebastian called from the back seat. Moore shrugged.
"I'm not, but I also don't feel like taking any chances."
For a brief moment, she caught Daniel looking at the book in her hand. There was no emotion on his face. He no longer had any connection to it.
"Get in," Wainwright said to her. "It's time to go."
Moore rode shotgun. Her hair was now knotted in a high ponytail. Sam and Sebastian rode in the next row, and Daniel sat alone in the far back seat. As he had done last October, Wainwright steered the ship. Kate's absence was felt by all but mentioned by none. Wainwright steered the SUV onto the off-ramp that would swing them around onto Kill Creek Road. Before they knew it, they were leaving the paved path behind for the noisy clatter of the gravel road, tiny chunks of shale hitting the undercarriage like inverted hail. The route was much darker than last time. the barren tree branches now overgrown with leaves. Sam squinted in the low light, staring straight ahead as the SUV passed through the tunnel of oaks and maples. There was sunlight in the distance, an oval of illumination, so far out of reach. Sam felt goosebumps prickling his flesh. The trees blocked out any trace of the blue sky. Their bushy limbs clasped over the road like the hands of a strangler. Sam could hear the slosh of gasoline in the trunk. That had been their last order of business before hitting the highway out of town. A quick stop at a gas station to buy and fill 2 10-gallon gas cans. That was the kill switch. If they found no answers in the third-floor bedroom, or if the house came violently alive and they were unable to even reach the wall, they would burn the whole damn place to the ground. Sam wasn't certain if that would stop the entity for good, but he hoped it would weaken it. It might buy them enough time to come up with a plan B. Their bodies swayed as the SUV rumbled down the winding lane. Sebastian's head was lowered, his eyes staring at the floor. Sam wondered what he was thinking. Since discovering him at Adudel's brownstone, Sebastian had been remarkably clear, his mind alert. There hadn't been one single moment where he seemed lost to some insatiable disease. Something had changed him since their trip to the house last year. And the closer they came to returning, the more frightened Sebastian appeared.
He doesn't want to go back, Sam thought. He doesn't want to end this.
Sebastian, Sam said softly. Sebastian turned.
Yes, Sam.
Are you sure you want to do this?
The old man smiled, but there was sadness in his eyes, as if he knew he were about to lose something irreplaceable.
Whatever the house is doing, it can't go on, he said.
The SUV broke through the darkened passageway and sped into the sudden, brilliant light. The house was before them, crouching low in the overgrown yard. The tall grass appeared healthier than ever, thick and vibrant. But their eyes were drawn to the beech tree, the hanging tree, whose twisted branches had been devoid of life last autumn. In the months since, it had experienced a disturbing resurgence. Vibrant strings of green leaves draped its body like living jewelry. Thick vines snaked up its gnarled trunk, wrapping tightly to its splitting bark, holding it together, keeping it whole. A few leaves fluttered free in the light breeze, but the rest stuck tight, the long strands of greenery swaying back and forth like pendulums counting down the seconds to their arrival. 28. 12:45 p.m. Sam slammed the back door of the SUV shut. He carried the dark canvas bag slung over his shoulder by a tan nylon strap. The chisel and hammers clanked faintly within. Moore insisted on carrying the 20-pound sledge, relishing its weight in her hands. The five of them walked up the gravel drive. To each side, the tall grass rippled, independent of the breeze. As they reached the front porch, Daniel paused. He stared up at the third-floor window. Sebastian followed his gaze.
What do you see, Daniel?
Daniel whispered something, too low to make out.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Sebastian asked.
Keep them moving, Sam told himself. If they wait too long, they'll start to question the plan. They'll turn back.
Come on, let's go, Sam called back as he started up the front steps. His boots knocked softly on the wood as he crossed to the front door. Unlike last autumn, there were no vines curled around the doorknob. It was free for him to turn. Sam paused and glanced around the front porch. The vines that had once covered the planks had also withdrawn. They must have retreated into the tall grass. It made no sense, but then again few things did. Behind him, Wainwright bounced lightly and found that the wood had no give under his feet. In his hand, he carried the wooden baseball bat.
It's sturdier, he said. The porch, it seems almost brand new.
Sam turned back to the front door.
Here we go.
He twisted the knob. The door opened easily.
Did we lock it when we left last year?
Sam tried to remember.
Maybe someone entered after us and forgot to lock it. Or maybe the house wants you to enter,
his mind suggested. Sam pushed this away. Such thoughts would only lead to fear. Sam steeled himself and stepped inside. At first glance, it appeared the rooms were as they had left them. But soon they realized the interior was also in better condition. The house was impossibly clean. Not a speck of dust told of the passage of time. The wood of the walls and floor seemed richer than before. Even the furniture, still in place as instructed by Rachel Finch's will, looked freshly cleaned.
Healthy. The house seems healthy, thought Sam.
They tested the light switches as they hesitantly crept through the rooms. No power. This was not a surprise. The electricity had vanished with the removal of their generator on the 1st of November. In the kitchen, Wainwright twisted the knobs on the sink. No brown gunk. No fresh water. Nothing. They moved down the narrow hallway toward the main room. A wave of panic seemed to wash over Wainwright. What is it? Sam asked. Wainwright shook his head and forced himself to follow the others. They moved through the next room and into the foyer. They found themselves once again standing at the bottom of the stairs.
What do you think it has planned?
Sebastian asked. I don't know, Sam responded honestly. It knows we're here. If it wants to do anything to us, it will. The house creaked softly in the light wind, boards popping faintly in distant corners. No one spoke. They stood perfectly still, listening, straining to hear anything unusual. A footstep, a laugh, the echo of voices. They heard only the wind, whistling as it picked up briefly, pressing invisible hands against the window panes. Then the whistling faded. The wind died down. The weight of the intense stillness settled over them. The summer heat receded the moment they stepped through the front doorway, an occurrence they should have welcomed, but which instead unnerved them. There they stood, in the cold, quiet house, waiting for it to make the first move.
It's doing the same thing, Sam thought. Watching us. Waiting.
Moore adjusted her grip on the sledgehammer's handle, turned to Sam, and raised a thin, arched eyebrow. So? She asked.
How did I become the leader?
Sam wondered. He took a deep breath, letting the role he never asked for settle in.
We break through, Sam said.
Moore nodded her approval.
We break through.
The stairs creaked beneath their feet as they crept upstairs. Moore weighed the wicked sledge loosely in her hands as she climbed toward the second floor.
Be ready, she warned herself. This bitch can get to us in our own homes. No telling what it will do here.
Wainwright stayed close behind Moore. Sebastian was third, his hand on the rail, making sure both feet were planted firmly on each step before moving farther. Sam followed, his hands ready to catch Sebastian if he were to tumble. As always, Daniel trailed them, wrapped in a troubling silence. There were no ghosts waiting for them on the second floor. The stained glass window at the far end of the hall offered a cheery alternative to the shadows that cloaked the top of the stairs. They passed the closed doors to their right and left, each taking furtive glances at their old bedrooms, memories of their first visit to Kill Creek rushing back to them. When Moore turned the sharp corner into the alcove at the end of the hall, she stopped, her feet butting up against the first step of the next set of stairs. The others gathered around her, all taking a moment to peer through the gloom at the brick wall above them. Behind it, they had been told, was the third-floor bedroom, the place where the last gasp of air left Rebecca Finch's lungs, the room Rachel Finch sealed shut after her sister's death. "Fuck it," Moore said. She trudged up the stairs, reared back the sledge, and let out a fierce cry. The hammer's head collided with the red bricks, chipping a chunk away. It skittered down to the bottom of the stairs. Sam stared at the chunk of brick, afraid. It was as if they had just sucker-punched a bully. The red shard of brick like a drop of blood against the wood floor.
If the house wasn't awake before, it is now.
Above, the pounding continued, the clanking of the hammer growing louder as Moore put more muscle into it. But unlike the first swing, the subsequent ones had little effect on the wall. No matter how hard she attacked the bricks, their edges remained intact, the mortar secure. Before long, despite the coolness of the house, beads of sweat were rolling down her face. "Anyone who thought this wall was gonna come tumbling down can kiss my ass," she called down to the others. Sam set the canvas bag down, and Wainwright quickly unzipped it. He set down the baseball bat and rifled through the various items in the bag, pushing aside the Bible Moore had purchased, and snatching up a chisel and the smaller framing hammer. He took the stairs two at a time, all the way to the top, set the edge of the chisel into the mortar between the bricks. Soon there was the clank of two hammers working, their heads pounding in a steady rhythm. Gray dust floated through the air as tiny bits of mortar sprang free, but still the wall held fast. With a slight groan, Sebastian pressed his hands against either side of the narrow stairwell and lowered himself down onto the first step.
"You all right?" Sam asked.
Sebastian smiled wearily.
"Yes, yes, of course."
"He's lying," Sam thought.
Sam watched Moore and Wainwright at work, arms whipping around in half circles. Moore's sledge brutally attacking the wall, Wainwright's hammer connecting with the butt of the chisel. A dense cloud of mortar dust was building around them. Wainwright pulled the neck of his shirt up over his nose and mouth, shielding his lungs from the abrasive air.
"I'm sorry you had to come back here," Sebastian said suddenly.
He had turned his attention to Daniel, who was standing a few feet behind them.
"It must be especially hard for you, considering..."
Sam watched Daniel, unable to predict his reaction. Daniel's slack cheeks reddened, a rim of tears rising to his eyes. He clenched his jaw, fighting the sorrow, swallowing it, pushing it down, down, down into the pit of his stomach, where he had held it for nearly 6 months. Anger flashed across his face, wild and untamable, and then it was gone, his moist eyes drying, his face returning to the disturbingly blank expression he had worn since they found him in Chicago. Ignoring Sebastian, Daniel swiveled around to Sam. "The elevator. Can't we take that up?" Before Sam could respond, Wainwright called down from the top of the stairs.
"There's a wall on that side, too. Brick, just like this one. Besides, there's no electricity. The elevator wouldn't work anyway."
Muttering something under his breath, Daniel lowered his head and stepped farther back into the hallway.
"Daniel?" Sam asked, not bothering to mask the concern in his voice.
"I'm okay, I'm okay."
"You sure?"
Daniel nodded, a bit too enthusiastically. The tears were back, threatening to spill over.
"Yeah, yeah, I'm just going to go downstairs for a second. Maybe step outside, get some air."
"I'll go with you," Sam said. Daniel threw a hand up in the air.
"No!"
he barked. Then with more restraint, "I just need a minute." He hurried off down the hallway.
"Should we go after him?"
Sebastian asked once Daniel had disappeared down the far stairs.
No, he'll be fine, Sam replied. There was doubt in his voice. 29.